Hey everybody, it is great to be with you, whether you're here in the room or joining us online. It's an honor to have you along for the ride. And by the way, a very special welcome to those of you who are joining us for the first time, or maybe the first time in a long time. You didn't know it when you walked in or tuned in or someone sent you the link, but this is one of those like best possible weekends ever to visit Keystone, because today we're beginning a brand new series called The Rest of the Story. And you got to say it like that, the rest of the story. And if you're over 40, you know what I'm talking about. And if you're not, you don't know. And you need to Google it, friends. But anyway, the rest of the story is a series in which we're going to explore some of the most iconic narratives in the Old Testament of the Bible. And we're going to explore them like you've never heard them before. And so to get us going, I want to share with you a question that a friend asked me years ago that, as it turns out, provided the spark for this series. And so the question he said was like this. He said, do you ever struggle to believe that some of the Old Testament stories actually happened? And he was basically saying, you know, when we read some of the more epic Old Testament narratives, are we reading history? And that's a great question, because if we're being honest, there is some pretty incredible stuff in there. Plus, if you grew up in church like I did, then you were probably taught to read every word of the Old Testament literally, and you were taught that anyone who didn't read every word literally didn't really believe in the Bible or God or Jesus or any of it, right? And if you grew up in church like I did, that perspective probably worked pretty well for you until the day that someone asked you some version of this question. And for me, the friend in question who asked the question was my overly analytical college roommate, John. Shout out to John if he's watching online. But I'll never forget the day when, following a visit to a church where we listened to a sermon that outlined the various types of fish that could have swallowed Jonah and kept him alive for 3 days, he looked at me, I think we were even at Panera Bread, he looked at me and said, how can you possibly believe that all of those Old Testament stories actually happened? He's like, I mean, come on. Do you really believe that a guy named Jonah was eaten by a fish and somehow lived to tell the tale? Or he said, while we're on the topic, and then he like got on the invisible soapbox. Do you have friends that do this when they're trying to persuade you? Very obnoxious. Not you, John. You were, yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah. But anyway, he's like, while we're on the topic, what about that account that says that the sun literally stood still in the sky so ancient Israel could win a battle against her enemies? He's like, that would disrupt like every law of physics and pretty much destroy the universe. He said, or how about the story of Samson? He's like, that dude was pretty much the Jewish Hercules, right? Like, there's no way that his life played out as described in the Old Testament. Come on, the guy who wrote about his story said one day that he killed 1,000 men with the jawbone of a donkey. He goes, I don't even think that's a weapon, right? How then can any intellectually honest person read something like that and assume it's history? And I remember he's on his soapbox. I'm midway through my sandwich at Panera, and I remember the thought, I'm not sure what to say right now, which is unusual for me. Yeah. I remember thinking, like, if there's a God, and I firmly believe that there is, then all of those things are certainly possible, because with God, anything is possible. But that day, I just didn't say much, because I didn't know what to say. In fact, I didn't know what to say in answer to this question until years later, when I was taking an introduction to the Old Testament class in seminary. Now, seminary is grad school for pastors. It sounds like cemetery. Sometimes it feels like it. Not always, but sometimes, right? But I remember it was in that class that I was introduced to an alternative way to read those Old Testament stories, a way that can be very helpful, especially to people who struggle to reconcile some of what they read in the Old Testament with their experience of the world. And it's a way that actually has deep roots within the Jewish tradition. And of course, the Jews are the ones that originally gave us the Old Testament. It's a way of reading that invites us to experience the Old Testament literarily before we try to read it literally. And I remember the day the professor said, I'm not saying you don't read it literally. He said, I would encourage you to prioritize a literary reading, because this way allows us to look past some of those unexplainable and seemingly impossible events in the story to consider the message that God wanted to convey to his people through that inspired story. as well as to discover why the people of Israel have chosen to tell and retell and retell these stories to their children for thousands of years. I'm telling you, after years of leveraging this approach, this literary before literarily, I'm convinced that it's an absolutely profound way to experience these narratives. And that's why for the first part of this summer, I want us to revisit some of these stories and explore them as you may have never heard before, to show you in a very real sense the rest, pause, of the story, right? So now, that said, before we get to the first story that I want to unpack with you today, I want to talk to you briefly about another question that I think is super important in all this. And this other question goes like this, real simple. What is the Bible? Because to be honest, it's not what many people think that it is. And here's what I mean. I brought a prop. Yes, friends, it is my Bible. You're like, he's never had a Bible on stage before. I know, first time for everything, right? But yeah, so here's the deal. Though the Bible looks like a book, it doesn't read like a book because it isn't really a book. It's actually a collection of 66 different books that are organized into two sections. We call the sections, of course, the Old Testament and the New Testament. And most of us are very familiar with the New Testament, right? It was written by a handful of people over a very short period of time, and it chronicles the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, as well as the growth of the church in the first century AD. So that's the New Testament. The Old Testament, though, it's a bit more complicated. It was written by 40 different authors over the course of 1,200 years, and it contains several distinct types of literature, including poetry and prophecy and wisdom and narrative. And within the narratives, there's a lot of diversity as well. You find stories about wealth and fame and treason and espionage and war and crime and punishment and love and kindness and grace and mercy. Moreover, and this is pretty amazing, as we dig into some of these narratives, you'll pretty quickly recognize that, well, you don't even really need to believe in God to appreciate them. And here's why I say that. Many of the people in these narratives had real questions about God. And so as we dig into these stories in the coming weeks, you're going to see that some of these people were asking questions that you may have asked from time to time. Questions like, is God who he says he is? Is he worth following? And then at times, is he even there at all? But here's the thing we need to remember. Even as messy and full of questions as these Old Testament stories are, the people of Israel still chose to write them down. And they did so during a time where there was no printing press or internet or even paper. Moreover, they did it during a time when they had been forcibly removed from their land and they were wondering if they'd ever get to return. In other words, these ancient Jewish people believed that these stories were so precious, they were so valuable, they were so inspired, that they were willing to do whatever it was going to take to make sure that they made it to the next generation. Because they believed that they had been given to them as a gift by God. Okay, so that brings me to the first narrative that I want to explore with you in this series. And it's the story of Noah's Ark. I had some fun finding pictures. I just found this one online. I don't know where it's from. It's just from the internet. So there's my source, you know, if you've ever tried that. Anyway, now, if you were taught this narrative as a kid in Sunday school like me, then you likely, as a young one, thought it was about cute little animals and maybe dinosaurs piling into a massive boat, right? And maybe for you, your parents even decorated your bedroom with images of the story. I would just argue, in hindsight, that is a bit strange, okay? Because everybody not on the ark died, okay? So not a great nursery theme. If you already bought it, no judgment, right? I know it's for sale, and I think the people in China are like, they really want the Noah's Ark? Okay, fine, whatever, right? We're making it. So anyway, it's an odd story. And as a result, in my experience, most of us adults just simply ignore it. But see, I'm convinced that's a mistake because when you approach the Noah narrative literarily, before you try to read it literally, you'll see that it's not primarily a story about a flood. It's a story about a very different kind of God who wanted to reintroduce himself to people in the ancient world. And so before I show you what I mean by that, let me briefly remind you of a few of the key details from the story of Noah, beginning with the fact that it's found in the very first book in the Bible. It's a book called Genesis, and it's one of the oldest recorded documents in human history. And it begins with an account of how everything came to be, not just people, but everything. It talks about how God created light and dark and heaven and earth and land and sea and plants and animals. And then on the last day of creation, how he made people. So that's how Genesis begins. But the author of Genesis also tells us only six chapters later, so just turn the page, that God had in pretty quick amount of time become so consumed with regret for creating people that he decided to destroy everything and start over. Seriously, the author of Genesis described it this way. He wrote, "The Lord, speaking of God, saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time." Boy, thanks, author of Genesis. Right. He goes on, "The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them." So here's what I find so significant about the opening sentences of the Noah story. The author recorded that something was happening in the human race that impacted how God thought about all the people. Well, almost all the people. The author continued. He said, "But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord," which of course raises a great question. I mean, if God is sideways with the entire human race and consumed with regret, like, what did Noah do? How did Noah find himself in favor with God when God was so frustrated with everyone else? And fortunately, the author told us as he continues, he says, Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time. And then this is, I think, the key. He walked faithfully with God. I would argue that what set Noah apart was his proximity to God. Said a bit differently, the most significant thing we learn in the opening verses of this story is that Noah mattered to God, and God mattered to Noah. And so what allowed God to favor Noah and to set him apart from everyone else was the relationship that Noah had cultivated with his creator. Okay, so now most of you know where the story goes from here. God essentially decided to reboot all of creation. If you're from the earlier days of the computer, Control-Alt-Delete, okay, right? Some of you are like, I don't know what that is. You can ask later, again, the internet. But reboot creation with Noah and his family. And here's why I say that. If you go back to the beginning of Genesis, you'll read that in the beginning, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering, and look at this, over the waters. It's like before there was anything, there was water, which should make us wonder, like, how is that even possible? Well, to the ancient Jewish people, water represented chaos, where there was no order. And so into that chaos, God spoke. His words became flesh. He created everything that had ever been created. And then, again, only six chapters later, God decided to uncreate that world. He looked down with regret and decided to return the world to its initial state, devoid of life and completely covered, this time in literal water. The only difference is that this time God took Noah and his family and the animals that would be needed to repopulate the earth and placed them on an ark that could carry them into their new beginning. But of course, this new beginning also necessitated the rest of humanity be wiped out. So I think it's more than fair to ask, like, why would anyone decide to record this story and pass it along to future generations? And I would argue that we tend to ask that question because we read this story from our perspective in history. And we need to remember that this story and all the other stories we'll talk about in the coming weeks weren't originally written to us. They were written to ancient people who, as it turns out, wouldn't have been bothered at all by the story of a devastating worldwide flood. In fact, these ancient people might even be a little bored with the Noah story because flood stories were common in ancient civilizations. There's even a famous account that predates Israel's flood story by several hundred years called the Epic of Gilgamesh, and it's epic. And it's of Gilgamesh. Thank you. Right. So, and here's just a quote from the Epic of Gilgamesh to show you how these stories had a lot in common. So here's what the author wrote. He said, "O man of," and I'm not even trying to pronounce that. You can try on your own time, right? "O man of this, son of this." Okay. "Tear down your," I love it when pastors just like plow through it. And you're like, that's not the right way to say that. I was like, I'm not even going to try. Okay. "Tear down your house and build a boat. Abandon wealth and seek living beings. Spurn possessions and keep alive living beings. Make all living beings go up into the boat, because there's a flood a-coming." All that to say, ancient people who heard the story of Noah would have thought, oh, here's another guy who got angry with people and destroyed the world. No big deal. But here's the thing. This is not where the story of Noah ends. In fact, as it continues, the story takes a turn that would have shocked the first people to hear it. The author wrote this. "But God remembered Noah." And I know we read that and think, okay. But if I did the math right, when God remembered Noah, this happened 371 days after the flood began, 371 days after Noah and his family and the animals entered the ark, which meant that Noah and his family had been shut up with a bunch of animals floating through darkness and chaos for over a year, and that apparently during that time, God had been silent. And remember I talked about how people in these ancient stories ask a lot of the same questions we tend to ask? Well, I suspect that during that year, there were more than a few moments that Noah would have felt abandoned. I mean, he had done everything that God had asked him to do, and then God sort of ghosted him. And I don't know if you've ever gone through a season like that in your life where you just felt like, okay, God, I feel like I'm being obedient and you haven't, what are you doing? You haven't talked to me. I don't even know where you went. But if you've had an experience like that, I'm telling you, a season where you kept asking, you know, where is God? Noah is your dude because he was asking those same questions. Again, over a year going, God, where are you? Before God moved in his direction. But then God did move, and he moved in dramatic fashion. Here's what the author of Genesis tells us. He says, "God sent a wind over the earth, and the waters receded." And he goes on to say, "The waters stopped falling from the sky, and the wind kept blowing until the day that the earth was finally dry. And God told Noah and his family they could exit the boat." And then he made them the most incredible promise. Here's what he said. "Never again will I curse the ground because of humans." And this is the key. "Even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood." Again, thanks a lot, right? Yeah. "But never again will I curse the ground because of humans. Even though they're not going to be great." He goes on. "And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done." In other words, God said, even though people will continue to sin and sin badly, I will never again uncreate what I have created. "Moreover," God said, "I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you." And look at this. "And with every living creature that was with you, never again will all life be destroyed by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me." And look at this. Not just Noah and his family, this and the earth and everything. And everyone. And so now, I don't know if you noticed, but there was a word that showed up in this context of God's promise to never again destroy the earth. And the word is covenant. And covenant in ancient times was a legal term used to define the terms of relationship between two parties. And the fact that a God established a covenant with human beings would have communicated something incredible to those human beings, namely that this God, the creator God, the one true God, was different because he desired to have a relationship with imperfect people. And because they were imperfect, the relationship had to be based on his faithfulness to them and that, not their faithfulness to him, because that wasn't going to work. So said a bit differently, the only requirements for this covenant, this relationship, fell on God. So should the people fall into sin, and they would, and we do, God would still keep his promise. And I'm telling you, the first people to hear this story would have thought, this God is unlike anything we've ever imagined. They would have thought, come to think about it, this flood story isn't like all the other flood stories we've heard. The story is different. This God commits to living with sinful, broken people in a completely new way, a way that their lives are preserved and protected, and it's all done by him and because of him and through him, which brings us back to where we started today. I mean, we hear all of that and ask ourselves, why in the world did this story matter enough to write down and pass on? What was it that the children of Israel found so compelling? And what does it have to say to all of us today? And in order to answer that, I want you to imagine something with me. I want you to imagine that you lived in ancient times, somewhere in the Mediterranean region, and that you'd never traveled more than a few miles from where you were born because there was no way to travel. And imagine that you found your spouse and your job and raised your kids and grew your crops and made money in the only land you had ever known. And now imagine that one day, out of nowhere, there is a flood that came and wiped everything out. I mean, you lost your crops, you lost your animals, you lost your hope for the future. I mean, if that were you, what would you do? And if you're anything like me, as I imagine this, I would probably start to look for causes. Like, I'd try to figure out why it happened. Like, what did I do? And in the world into which the Noah story was introduced, it was pretty much universally accepted that bad things were caused by frustrated gods. Why do bad things happen? Because the gods are angry. And ancient people never asked, why do bad things happen to good people? We ask that question, right? But they never asked that question because in their minds, there were no good people. There were just bad people. And when people got bad enough, then the gods did what they had to do in order to wipe them out and start over and reboot the experiment. That's just how life worked. And that's why ancient people spent their entire lives trying to appease these gods that they really didn't understand. They made altars and offered sacrifices, and if something happened, then they thought, well, I guess we didn't sacrifice enough, or I guess we messed up so badly that God or the gods had to do what they have to do, and now all we have to do is all we can do is to pick up the pieces and move forward. Because that's just how it works. And it was into that world that the story of Noah delivered the message that there's a God who wants something for people and not just something from people. And if you grew up in church, you're like, oh yeah, I get that. God wants something for me and I get that. I said, you don't understand. In the ancient world, this did not bubble up from human conscience and thinking alone. This was a revelation to ancient people, that there's a God who wants something for them and not just something from them. And that's why the first people who heard this story would have thought, this isn't really about a flood. This is about an entirely different kind of God, a God who doesn't want to wipe people out, but a God who wants to invite people in. And not to invite them into rules and sacrifices and religion. This God, and this would have been mind-blowing, wants to invite people into relationship, to walk with him. Relationship with him that is held together by him. And so I get it. I mean, I have friends that are skeptics, and we have lunch, and we talk. But we tend to approach a story like this and think, man, it's so primitive, and it's so regressive, and it's so unbelievable. But I hope you're also hearing that it's a mistake to dismiss this story, because to do so is to miss the entire point of the story. The story really has nothing to do with the flood or the animals in the boat. It actually has very little to do with Noah. The point of the story is that for the very first time since the Garden of Eden, people were introduced to a God who desires to have a relationship with them and who desires good things for them. And the heart of this God is revealed in the aftermath of chaos and destruction and demise. All of a sudden, ancient people were introduced to a really good God, making a really big point that he is for people. And I would argue that understanding has the potential to change everything for them and for us. Which brings me to one more thing that I wanted to share. I suspect that a few of you who are skeptical, analytical in nature, can't believe you're here this morning because you're like, dude, I would be your friend John and on my soapbox, so it's kind of fun and I'm glad you're here and we're honored you're here. But I suspect that there's a few of you here right now that are thinking something like, okay, cool, but are you saying that you actually believe this happened? Okay? And if that's you, I want you to think about something. I want you to think about the idea that God is so serious about having a relationship with you that if you were to keep reading the Bible after the Noah story, you'd eventually reach a story in the Bible that we can verify historically, the story of the Son of God who came to earth to lay down his life, to rise from the grave, so that we could have an invitation to everlasting life and a perfect relationship with our Father in heaven. And so I guess what I'm saying is if you're here and you kind of hold your faith at a distance because you really don't understand the Noah story and how it could be literal and historical, I would encourage you to just let that go for a moment, because really your faith should hinge on the confidence that the Noah story points people to the ultimate story. And the point of the Noah story is the same as the point of the ultimate story. That God doesn't want to wipe you out. He wants to invite you in. He's done everything other than force you to accept the invitation to a restored relationship with him in Jesus, because he loves you and he wants to walk with you through this life and into the next. All that to say, I think the story of Noah survived because it was a divinely inspired quantum leap forward in what people thought about when they thought about God. And if you're here and you're still hung up on the historicity, and if you're thinking, I don't know, I still have so many questions when it comes to these stories, and I totally get that, I want to invite you to come back next week. Because my hope is that as we explore some of these other stories, you'll start to appreciate the Bible for what it is, a library of literature that has something powerful and progressive to speak into your life today. And you'll start to see God for who he is, someone worth following. And that, my friends, is the rest of the story. I have been waiting so long for that. All right, yeah, good stuff. All right. And now, if you're willing and able, if you could stand, and I'll close our time together in prayer. And once again, we do this every week if you're new around here, but if you've come into this place and you're like, yeah, that's really interesting with Noah, I really need to pray with someone, we have some friends that will be under the screen to the left who would love to spend some time with you and just to pray with you. But for the rest of us, let me close our time in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you. Thank you for engaging ancient people in a language that they could understand. And thank you for the grace that you demonstrated to them. Thank you for the way the Noah story points us to the ultimate story. And thank you that the ultimate expression of your love to us broken, sinful people was when you sent your one and only Son, Jesus, to be the way to peace with you. So for today, we just stand in awe and wonder of who you are and what you've done. And I pray that this week we would all chase down the personal implications of this idea that you want something for us and not just something from us. But for today, for this moment, we just want to say thank you. Thank you for your love. Thank you for your grace. It is in the matchless name of your Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ, we pray. And everyone said, amen. Grace and peace to you, friends. We'll see you next week.